Hello, my name's Chris Galvin. Welcome to ICOCA's podcast series, Future Security Trends, Implications for Human Rights. This season, we're marking ICOCA's 10-year anniversary by looking back to the founding and early years of the association, meeting some of the leading figures who were instrumental in both shaping the vision of the organization and getting the initiative up and running. Today, I'm delighted to be talking to Amal Mehra, who is now Director of Industry Programs at Laudes Foundation, who was one of the founding board members of ICOCA, where he sat representing the civil society pillar, having founded the International Corporate Accountability Roundtable, ICAR. So Amal, welcome, and as you know, ICOCA is a multi-stakeholder initiative with civil society being one of the key three membership and governance pillars. Back in those early days of the association, what was the vision for the CSO pillar and what were the challenges in making that vision a reality?
Yeah, well, thanks so much for having me on to discuss ICOCA. It's incredible that it's been 10 years since the initiative was launched, and I believe really marks an important milestone in the development of business and human rights and standards that are applicable to sectors like private security. When the civil society pillar was put together, we really thought we would build constituencies that reflected the diversity of civil society perspectives on the issue. So we had a member that was very much connected with communities that were at the forefront or engaging with private security in their own backyard. And then we had groups like ICAR or myself participating more from the sort of principles and business and human rights legal standards approach. And what we really wanted to do was bring that perspective together, like what is the lived reality of communities that are interacting and engaging with private security in their backyard with the evolving expectations on private security from standards like the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, and how could they all sort of be merged together to bring a common perspective or approach from civil society into the discussions.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the dynamic within the pillar itself? Because from the sounds of it there's different profiles of organizations from, you know, the likes of Global North and maybe global organizations to real community-based. So how did that figure out?
Yeah, I think it's a good point. I mean, the reality is that civil society is diverse, and that's its strength. And in processes like multi-stakeholder initiatives, because they tend towards the technocratic, they involve legal standards, application of legal principles, that oftentimes they kind of divorce themselves from the lived experience of those that are directly on the ground. So what we thought was really critical was to have a partner from the beginning, and that was through Tricia Feeney's work from RAID UK, kind of be a conduit or a channel for some of those perspectives and to lift the perspectives of those that were directly being impacted by private security operations into the negotiations and the code development and implementation. So it was really kind of a critical piece of what we wanted to build as part of the civil society pillar. And I think it led to more robust discussions and outcomes because we could really bring forward how this industry engages with communities on the ground in ways that I think had we focused on more of the legal civil society angle, we wouldn't have been able to have that color.
And was there any kind of reticence on the behalf of any of the civil society members, you know, the idea of getting around the same table as these large corporations and private security companies? Was there any kind of pushback against that idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that, again, because of the diversity of civil society, it also means that they deploy a range of different tactics, from engagement to advocacy to activism. And so we had partners that were part of the civil society pillar that were both kind of engaging in legal tactics and advocacy, who also were at the table wanting to move the industry forward by lifting the standards so that laggards would follow. So I think, I don't know if there was necessarily reticence to play at the table as much as there was an understanding that ICOCA existed within a broader ecosystem of accountability and that the standards development and its implementation through ICOCA was critical and there needed to be alternative and other tactics used to address some of the pernicious problems in the industry that weren't going to be solved through a multi-stakeholder initiative. Like, you know, the behavior of non-members of ICOCA or, you know, domestic private security contractors or, you know, conflict affected areas where it was really too hard to get any lens into how companies are operating.
which is why working with these community-based organizations is so critical, because they are the eyes and ears on the ground. So tell us a little bit more about the kind of dynamic, you know, around that table then. You've got civil society organizations, you've got governments, you've got businesses trying to work towards this common goal. Was that easy to achieve?
No, I don't think it was particularly easy. I mean, I think part of the ICOCA's journey was that it was one of the first major multi-stakeholder initiatives to get off the ground, obviously the first in this sector. The sector itself is relatively, you know, nascent. So it hasn't been a focus or scrutiny in the past 100 years. It really has developed more recently. So what that means, I think, is that you had to both kind of get heads around and people around a table to address a sector that was quickly emergent and increasing in its power and scope, both the types of services that were provided and the clients of these companies. And then you also had to do something new, which is bring a collaboration, a multi-stakeholder collaboration with security sector companies, governments, and civil society together to try to set a framework around it. So I think that those both aspects made it kind of a challenge. But I think really credit goes to the Swiss government, who really had patience and commitment and putting patient resources and will into getting the initiative off the ground, supporting civil society participation, and continuing to call for the participation of other governments to be at the table. So I think, but for the Swiss seeding it and supporting it, I don't know if it would have yielded the same result.
And would you say there's a kind of a secret sauce to getting consensus, if that's the right word, with multi-stakeholder initiatives, other than that has to be a conducive environment, of course, and that support, that, you know, regular support from the Swiss government, as you say?
Yeah, I think I've done a bunch of multi-stakeholder initiatives, and I believe in the power of multi-stakeholder initiatives. And I think they work best when you have individuals who have clear accountability within their roles participating in the negotiations or the discussion. So senior leaders who can move their businesses or make commitments on behalf of their business or government or entity, if it was civil society. I think you also need trust, and you need to have the ability to have difficult conversations where you might say the wrong thing or inadvertently offend, but you're there for a bigger purpose and mission, and that there's trust that everyone's at that table for the same objective or outcome. And I think the third thing is really trying to align those objectives or outcomes. And so part of that is building that collaboration and that trust, but also it's really kind of mapping where the win-win-win space is from governments, from companies, and from civil society. I mean, quite honestly, in a sector that had been largely unaccountable, the win was building a framework that allowed for some measure of accountability and performance and meeting of standards for the sector from a civil society perspective. That same win is, I think, a win that was relevant to members of the private security sector that participated, because they were finding themselves competing with scofflaws or poor industry performers who were able to, you know, benefit from lower costs or what have you, but weren't meeting the standard. And that same objective, I think, was aligned with governments who did not want to be employing or contracting with companies that were violating rights. So I think once we found that space of alignment, of lifting a standard that kind of supported leadership behavior from companies and built accountability over the actions of companies in the sector, I think once we aligned on that, then it was became about how do we operationalize that.
Now, you've mentioned accountability a couple of times there. And of course, you set up the International Corporate Accountability Roundtable. So I'm interested to hear what role you think the civil society pillar should be playing in really ensuring accountability of private security companies. And how did you operationalize that?
Yeah. And again, I think the reality is ICOCA exists within a broader accountability ecosystem. So what I mean by that is no multi-stakeholder initiative will solve for an industry on its own. What a multi-stakeholder initiative can do best is aggregate consensus, aggregate, you know, actors and build consensus around a common applicable standard and framework, and then the systems of accountability around that. So I think within ICOCA, the role of civil society was to ensure that the standard was high, that was consistent with international legal standards and human rights law, and that it was being implemented and enforced through ICOCA membership or procurement kind of linkages with governments. Outside of ICOCA, I think civil society has a much more active role to play, which is to monitor the sector writ large, to keep ICOCA accountable to participation as a multi-stakeholder initiative in the broader business and human rights ecosystem, and to sort of deploy other tools that might leverage companies' participation in the initiative and or drive higher accountability, like, you know, media campaigns, engagement, advocacy, et cetera. So I think ICOCA, again, as I said, exists within that broader ecosystem, but it is a part of that ecosystem.
Now, you know, you mentioned before, I think you used the word technical, and I just want to hone in on a little that because, and especially when we work with civil society organizations, what we find it challenging, difficult sometimes to really get this issue to resonate with broader public, civil society organizations there. They can see these issues on the ground, they're eager to work on them, but often, you know, they don't have the resources to do so. What can ICOCA be doing, do you think, to get more people interested in the issues at stake here and to maybe move it from being seen as a kind of a, you know, a very technical, marginal issue to one that's really more central to some of the key issues of our day? And I'm thinking particularly about just transition. If you think about private security companies and their role as the interface between companies that are operating in very high-risk environments, mining for minerals, etc., and the communities where they operate, they play a very critical role, but it's difficult to get people to understand that. What should we be doing to help join the dots?
I think one of the tricky parts with the way the private security sector has been developed is that almost overnight, the state license on security and use of force, et cetera, was quickly sort of privatized. And so I think part of it is like an awareness raising. I don't know if people understand the full scope of private security contractor operations, where they're deployed, what they're deployed to protect or oversee. And so I think part of it is, as I said, like real awareness raising. I think the other part of it is bridge building, frankly. So understanding geographically where these companies are operating, providing transparency on that so that civil society can engage with those companies and kind of know who's in their backyard. This is something we found really vital in sectors like apparel, for instance, where once you empower workers with kind of insight about which companies are sourcing from their factories, it helps them build their own engagement with those companies. So I think something very similar can happen in private security. So I think transparency is critical there. And I think ICOCA as a secretariat can play a key role in sort of providing that data, that mapping, and those bridge building engagement potentials.
Yeah, and it's challenging. And one of the reasons for that, of course, is that nobody wants to admit to using security companies because of the kind of reputational issues that have gone along with that because of the legacy and the history, etc. But, you know, we're doing our bit to try and get more data point. For example, one of the things we've been doing is looking at the working conditions in the sector and particularly, you know, the plight of private security personnel themselves, because unfortunately, the many hundreds of thousands of people involved in the sector in these areas are really treated poorly. I mean, paid very poorly, treating very long hours, very little benefits, etc. So it's something we're working on, but it's challenging because people don't want to admit to using security.
I think you're right. I also think it's so interesting, the link you just made to just transition. I mean, this is something that we're actively looking at Laudis, sort of how do we support just transitions that are taking place around the world? And you're right, sort of the link to critical minerals and the ways that security is used around mining is one of these opportunities, I think, to show how ICOCA could be relevant to the context of the just transitions that are taking place around the world. So I think that's a really interesting opportunity for deeper engagement.
Well, we'll be doing a deeper dive on this at the upcoming Responsible Security Forum. We're holding our first, what we hope will be an annual event on the back of the AGA this year, doing a first kind of panel with OECD on exactly this, the just transition, because, yeah, we really do see private security here as being playing a central role in that many of these locations, if it's not factored in, not just because of the human rights violations that may occur with private security use, but also because of the rights holders themselves, as in private security companies, then that's not going to happen. So you mentioned Laudis a couple of times that your focus is on the apparel sector, but I'd be interested in your thoughts on what ICOCA should be doing to engage a kind of broader philanthropic community. I mean, you mentioned that, you know, the Swiss have been central right from the get-go, and they have in terms of the support for the organization. But in terms of diversifying the funding base, what should we be doing to make this issue something that will really resonate with philanthropists?
Yeah, so I mean, at Laudis, we work across industry transitions, and we focus on sectors that have a high contribution to the climate crisis. So primarily, that's the built environment and apparel. We also work on sectors that are emergent. So we're looking at food as a potential sector we could work on. And so really with the focus of our work increasingly on just transitions, I think that there are huge opportunities for us to sort of win for climate and for people outcomes. I think philanthropy generally has approached these issues from either sort of a rights perspective or a geographic perspective, and not so much from a sectoral perspective. So Laudis is kind of unique, I think, in our lens being focused on specific industries and their transition. And I do think philanthropy generally has a blind spot right now about the critical minerals and the transition minerals discussion. I know some donors are actively working on that and building some collaborations to do so. But I think sort of the knock-ons of the increased use of those minerals, like the ways that sectors that are subsidiary or secondary to energy, like security, frankly, have to sort of reorganize around those, I think we're just late to spotting those opportunities. So I think it's good for ICOCA and perhaps the Swiss and the other governments involved to continue to raise their awareness that it's not just an energy transition that needs to take place, but it's the sort of the secondary reorganizations of sectors that are linked to or dependent on or serve that energy transition. And I think that is the piece that Laudis is spotting. And I think others could benefit. I think ICOCA could really benefit from others spotting that too.
Well, we are coming up to the end of our current kind of 5-year strategic plan, and there's some work going on right now about the next 5 or 10 years even. And I think one thing that we should be thinking is exactly what you're talking about there, and where we position ourselves in terms of just transition and energy transition and the role of security and all of that.
Yeah, I also think this will open you up to very different civil society participants and engagement, including those that might be more at the nexus of the climate agenda. And I think this is a huge growth opportunity for ICOCA and its significance. I also wonder, I haven't done the research on this, but you all will have, which is like the types of companies that are existing under ICOCA membership now, are they also the companies that will be benefiting or involved in the sort of renewable contracts, the mining for critical minerals, et cetera? Or are we talking about like a different set of actors? So I guess the question is around scope, both for the companies and I think for the governments involved, because I do think that sort of next phase of work is looking at transition in and where those sort of minerals are coming from, what the sectors that are being set up are, and how those security provision around those work.
Yeah, and I mean, I think the short answer to that is that yes, the companies are absolutely involved in those kinds of contracts. And we are trying to deepen engagement with some host governments, you know, where these extractive sectors are operating. And increasingly, that's going to be in, you know, higher and higher risk environments as the demand for these minerals. So I think it's a great idea. And maybe we should kind of, you know, include you in this thinking process for the strategic planning. So Amol, thanks so much. Yeah, it's been really fascinating. We look forward to keeping in touch.
Yeah, appreciate it. Thanks so much. Take care.
Thanks so much. Bye.